This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Ta-Nehisi Coates is one of the most important voices in America today. When he made the case for reparations to be paid to African Americans for hundreds of years of slavery, those of us who read the article knew it would spark a long-neglected conversation, but we didn't know that its publication in The Atlantic last year would be a preamble to a long and scary season in which we've been talking about race and racism far too much. He's one of the leading journalistic voices writing about these issues. I spoke with Coates last week at Emmanuel Congregational Church in Hartford. He was in town to receive the 2015 Stowe Prize for writing to advance social justice from the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center. This is Ta-Nehisi Coates on Where We Live.
Why'd you start doing this work?
Baltimore's in the news right now, and people ask me, what do I think is going to, you know, come out of the events, out of Freddie Gray's death? What do I think is going to change? What's going on? When I went to Baltimore a few weeks ago, people, what did I see? Did it feel different? And one of the sad facts that I tell people is that, no, it felt the same to me. You know, it generally, you know, felt the same. And I expect that a year from now, it'll probably feel about the same, too. I say that because the Baltimore that people saw, I guess about a month ago, was a spectacle of a kind of particular violence. There was a CVS that was, you know, burning, and there were, you know, people in the street, you know, running all sorts of ways. There were, you know, what, you know, folks like to call a riot, and I'm only sort of mocking that a little bit because it pales next to what we would have called a riot in 1968. It's not even close in terms of the level. That was the violence that attracted people's eyes. That was the violence which the mayor went on TV to denounce. That was the violence which the president denounced, which, you know, community leaders denounced. But people who have lived in Baltimore, who have spent significant portions of their life in Baltimore, in the kind of communities where Freddie Gray was killed, and people who have spent time in those communities around the country, understand that life in those communities is inherently violent. Violence did not, you know, begin with the burning down of a CVS. Violence did not even, in those communities, did not even begin with the killing of Freddie Gray. And as a child, as a young person, you know, as a young African-American person in a city like Baltimore, you take that message at a very, very early age. And so as I've told people, you know, around the country, as I've talked about this issue, I can remember, for instance, being in middle school. And I can remember having to face a variety of choices before I went to school that had nothing to do with school, actually, or had everything to do with school. And so I had, you know, to think about what I was gonna wear to school. I had to think about how I was gonna cock my hat and what direction I was gonna cock it in. I had to think about how I was gonna wear my book bag. Was I gonna wear it on, you know, with one strap over the shoulder or two straps over the shoulder? Was I gonna wear, you know, my Nike hat or not? Who was walking with me? How many of them was it gonna be? What neighborhood were they from? And then when I got to school, I had to think about when it was time to leave school, how was I going home? Was I gonna, you know, take the long route and catch the bus to my grandmother's house? Was I gonna walk down Duke and down the hill and over? Was I gonna cut through the woods? Again, how many people were walking with me? Where were they from? Each of those choices, each of those decisions was about violence. Each of those choices and each of those decisions was about me finding some way to protect myself from the inherent violence of West Baltimore in that period. And I had, you know, friends and family, you know, who lived in Chicago, who lived in Philadelphia, you know, who lived in other cities and other neighborhoods like West Baltimore. And I understood that they followed similar rules, that they had, you know, a similar brain process when it was time to go to school. I understood, although I might not have put it like this then, that, you know, fully on a good day, probably about 30% of my brain during a school day was concerned with violence. And the rest of it was concerned with school. And then I would come home and I would cut on the TV and I, you know, would watch whatever show I was watching. You know, The Wonder Years, Family Ties, you know, later The Cosby Show. But what I would see is that, or what I would understand is that my way of life, my way of going through an average school day was in fact not the norm for most Americans. That there was a group of Americans who lived like me, and then there was a group of Americans who did not live like me. There's a group of Americans who, you know, for them, boyhood was just normal stuff. You know, you rode your bike over to your friend's house and you didn't have to think about whether you were crossing North Avenue or not and who was over there. When I grew up, if you were, you know, going into another neighborhood, your grandmother better live over there, you better have some cousins over there or something like that. What I understood was that my life was constricted by violence. And I knew that people who looked like me in America lived that way. And people who did not look like me lived in some sort of other way. And even at that age, at like 12 years old, you know, I was very, very interested in why that was the case. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, in many degrees, you know, the case for reparations is an attempt for me to answer that age-old question. So that's how I got started. Mm-hmm.
When you decided to make a case for reparations, there's a lot of ways that you can tell that story.
Yes.
A lot of other vehicles. But you used a word, reparations, and used a vehicle that really pushes on some edges of what America wants to talk about. I mean, a little bit further than what America wants to talk about. Why did you choose that? Why did you choose reparations as the vehicle for this conversation?
Well, first of all, it's correct. It became, you know, correct. I mean, it became clear to me. And I, you know, as someone who, you know, came from a very skeptical, you know, position on reparations only like a few years ago, it became quite clear that it was correct. You know, one of the hard things about, you know, being African-American in this country is that there's one level of things that you go through just, you know, that are just, you know, racism, right? It's just, you know, negotiating every day, you know, racism of living in a country. But then on top of that, there's another conversation in which people try to convince you that the things you see as a result of racism are actually not there. So it's a kind of head trip that's put on black people. You know, and so, you know, we have all sorts of, you know, other discussions to avoid a very, very uncomfortable reality. So you say, well, why is it that, you know, if you look at every socioeconomic statistic, African Americans are down here and white people in this country are up here? And they, you know, we'll talk about everything. Oh, it's, you know, it's class. Oh, it's culture. Oh, it's, you know, there's not, you know, enough fathers in the home. There's not this, there's not that. Everything except the most obvious thing in the world. And that is that any sort of honest reading of American history, any sort of, you know, sincere reading of black people's passage, you know, through this country's history, and African Americans are, you know, one of the oldest ethnic groups in this country, is a history of plunder, is a history of one group of people taking things from another group of people. And if you do that, if you have 250-odd years of slavery in this country, you follow that up with another 100 years of Jim Crow. And when I talk about Jim Crow, I just want to be clear, because when we talk about this, we think it means, like, you guys don't get to sit next to each other. Like, we don't get to have integrated pews like we have now. And that's a part of it. But understand that Jim Crow, at its core, is a system of plunder. Okay? Your inability to vote is not just your inability to participate in some sort of, you know, symbolic ritual. It's an inability to make a decision about the tax dollars that you pay like every other American. It's an inability to have a, you know, a fair say, you know, in where the resources in this country, which you are, you know, a citizen of, are invested. And so it's continual plunder, which is not to talk, you know, even about, you know, the labor situation in a place like the South, for instance. If you have generation upon generation upon generation upon generation upon generation of plunder in this country, of extraction from African-American communities, and you take that wealth and you put it into other people's communities, the expectation that within 50 years of half-hearted efforts, the results of that extraction will disappear, you know, it's fanciful. And so, like, the question about, the Negro problem, as they used to say, the race problem, the racial cat, however, you know, whatever euphemism you want to use, it's not mysterious at all. You know, it's the record of American history. And it's not, you know, I feel like I'm saying something very radical. But in fact, it's not radical, you know? It's just true. It's not radical at all. It's only radical because we've decided, you know, to blind our eyes to certain things.
It's always been in some ways radical, but it's something that Americans used to at least talk about in the 1800s. I mean, there was conversation about
there
it,
was, yes.
But that conversation has gone away. Why did the conversation dry up over these really 200 years?
The problem with reparations is actually not the money. I don't think the money is actually the problem. I think the problem is that in paying the money, you have to cop to certain things, okay? And I didn't really appreciate this, to be honest with you, until like the past, you know, five or six years. America thinks of itself, you know, with this whole concept of exceptionalism. You know, we are somehow nobler than other countries, and that doesn't come out of nothing. You know, America is, you know, I think distinguished not among all nations, but among, you know, most nations, in being a creedal country. We were established based on certain values, and that's what makes you American. What makes you American is this belief that you have the right to pursue your happiness and do as you please as long as you, you know, obey the law. The problem with African Americans is that African American history runs counter to that entire idea. You know, and it doesn't, you know, it's not a minor exception. You know, it's not, you know, as I tell people, you know, slavery is not like a bump on the road to something better. Slavery is the actual road. In 1860, in this country, at the advent of the Civil War, African Americans were something like, I don't know, like 3 billion in property in this country? If you wanted to, like, look at what the greatest export from this country was in 1860, 60% of all of our exports were cotton that went through slave hands, okay? If you went to a state like Mississippi in 1860, the majority of the people living in Mississippi were enslaved. If you went to a state like Louisiana in 1860, half the people living there were enslaved. South Carolina, the majority of the people there living enslaved. One-third of the entire population of the South enslaved. If you wanted to find where the richest, wealthiest population of Americans were in 1860, you went to the Mississippi River Valley, where there were more millionaires per capita than anywhere else in the United States. Slavery is not a small thing. There is no America without slavery. And so the problem with paying reparations is it forces you to admit that. It forces you to say, you know, this thing that we've been, you know, going to Iraq and telling people that we were, this thing that, this story we tell about World War II, you know, it's not quite true. It's not quite true. And so it puts us in a very, very uncomfortable, actually, I don't think hopeless place, but a very, very uncomfortable place.
You write about John Conyers, the Michigan congressman, actually raising legislation that, of course, has never really been talked about in Congress. But what that would force Congress to do, to actually have a conversation in the Capitol about this issue and use the word reparations, whether or not it has to do with money or not, but to raise some of these things. It seems, of course, like a pipe dream, but it also seems like the sort of conversation that probably needs to be had in that building specifically.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, people say, well, what do you think the first step is? And I actually do think that's the first step. I mean, the Capitol was built by slaves, you know? I mean, yeah, I mean, I can't think of anywhere else where it would be, you know, more appropriate. And it's quite sad because it's not like we have not, you know, paid reparations to people before. You know, I was on the radio when this story first came out, and I was talking to a gentleman, and, you know, he called in. He said, well, I'm against reparations. I feel like, you know, the things you're talking about in your article were too far back. And I said, okay, do you think we should have paid reparations to Japanese Americans who were interned? He said, yeah, of course. Of course we should have. I said, listen, this article is based on housing. It's based on redlining that happened after Japanese Americans were interned. Can you at least agree on that? He couldn't. You know, you couldn't even, like, even the recent stuff is a problem. Even if, you know, I've said this before.
But a lot of the argument is I didn't do it. My family didn't do it. I don't know anybody who did it. I wasn't involved in red line housing in Chicago. I never owned any slaves, so.
Yes, you did.
Yes, right?
Yes, you did. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a very, you know, for me, like, the most offensive portion, it's a very opportunistic way of looking at citizenship. It's, you know, when my country does something I am proud of, then I'm an American. When my country does something I'm ashamed of, I didn't do it. So on July 4th, right, you know, you weren't there on July 4th. You weren't around in 1776, right? But you all want to celebrate, and we all want to have hot dogs and hamburgers, right? We all went off for President's Day. Now we all went off for Martin Luther King Day. You didn't march on Washington. You know, why should you get off, right? We have some notion of the collective. I mean, this gets, like, really, really specific, you know? Pay my taxes this year. Me and my wife got our taxes done on time. We're very proud of that. Very happy with that. My tax money will not go to things that directly benefit me. Now, I can't write to the IRS and say, you know what? I'm not going to use that bridge that you're building out in Wyoming somewhere. That highway that you're repairing has nothing to do with me. Why should I have to pay for that? That's not, you know, how we construe the notion of citizenship itself. We are at this very moment, paying money out to the families of World War I veterans on pensions. Well, I wasn't alive for that. I didn't have anything to do. Why should my money have to go to that? And so it's clear that, you know, if we decided that as Americans, we would only pay for the things that we were directly, immediately responsible for, first of all, we would immediately cease to be Americans because we wouldn't have an America. You can't really have a state, the very definition of a state, in which a person is only responsible for what they individually themselves do, you know, at a particular moment.
And that's why it needs to be made clear that what you're talking about is not asking white Americans for reparations. You're talking about America.
That's right.
America,
exactly,
the country.
The state. The state itself. The state and the society itself, you know, which benefited from enslavement, as I, you know, laid out. The case for reparations, for the most part, deals with housing, even though I went through all these stats on housing. It is impossible to imagine the American middle class as we know it today without the active participation of the government during the New Deal, you know, through programs in which housing in this country in the suburbs was subsidized by the tax dollars of black people and white people, and yet black people were excluded from the entire process. You know, greatest wealth-building opportunity, arguably, in American history, certainly within the 20th century, and black people were excluded from it. And then we look and we see a wealth gap where, you know, white people in the average white family in this country has something like 20 times the wealth of the average black family. And people want to talk about, like, missing fathers. I mean, it's like, hello? I mean, this actually happened. This was a thing that really, really happened. You know, and when you deny people their opportunities, you know, to build wealth, and you give other people that opportunity, you know, there tend to be some effects.
You're listening to a conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates, who was in Hartford last week to receive this year's Stowe Prize for his work advancing the conversation about racism in America. We'll continue our conversation after this break. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. This hour, we're listening back to a discussion taped last week with Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's the 2015 winner of the Stowe Prize for writing to advance social justice. We spoke at Emmanuel Congregational Church in Hartford.
You mentioned missing fathers. Talk a little bit for us about this notion. It comes an awful lot from some in the black community who say the problem with urban black America is the fathers aren't around, mm-hmm. or there's disrespect amongst the children for their elders.
Right.
Mothers are in charge of the households,
right.
et cetera, et cetera, and you've heard it all. We hear this all the time. I don't know if it's meant to be an excuse. How do you respond to that, especially coming from the African-American community?
I tell people, first of all, I'm a fan of two-parent households. You know, I think kids require a lot of energy, and I think the more energy you can marshal towards raising kids, the better off for the child. You know, I just believe that. I grew up in a two-parent household. My first book, you know, is completely obsessed with fatherhood and is all about fatherhood. So, you know, it's not a question for me about would we be better off if we had more fathers involved in our children's lives. Of course we could. Of course we would. But is that the reason why we are where we are right now? Is that the reason why African Americans occupy the bottom portion, the socioeconomic spectrum? Because the fact of the matter is black people have been in that place for a really, really long time. You know, and so, you know, this rise that people cite in the proportion, you know, of African-American single-headed households, which, by the way, is not a testimony of whether your father's involved or not, by the way. That's not a testament to that at all. The bottom is old, you see? This is new. At the end of Case for Reparations, I talk about how Wells Fargo effectively fleeced the African-American community in Baltimore. These were not, you know, what people would classify as people, you know, among the underclass. These were people who were looking to buy homes or refinance loans on homes they had. The guys who I cite who did that study did another study recently. And what they found is that if you were living in Baltimore and you were white, the more money you made, the less likely it was that you had a subprime loan or a predatory loan. That makes sense. The more money you made if you were black, the more likely it became that you had a subprime or predatory loan. Effectively, black success in Baltimore made you a target. And if you, you know, go with, you know, the thesis that I offer here, that, you know, effectively we are in a system in which, you know, the dominant characteristic for African Americans is plunder, it actually makes sense that that's the way it would be. And so, like, having more fathers in the household can't stop Wells Fargo from fleecing millions of dollars out of Baltimore. Having more fathers in the household would not have saved Trayvon Martin.
One of the words you've used is plunder. Another word you use in this piece is disrespect. You talk about the essence of American racism is disrespect. And in the wake of the grim numbers, we see the grim inheritance. This year, in a piece that followed the Baltimore riots, you write about disrespect for the hollow law and failed order that so regularly disrespects the community. What does disrespect mean to you?
The fact of the matter is, the way, you know, white supremacy in this country has traditionally worked is it's often been the people who are the most successful, the most respectable, who are actually targeted. I mean, if you look at, like, the lynching riots during the Red Summers, for instance, one good way to get yourself lynched if you were living in Mississippi, you know, if you were living in Tennessee where Ida B. Wells was to own some property and to insist on your own independence. The Ku Klux Klan didn't go around burning, you know, black brothels. You know, they burnt down black schools and black churches, basically places where black people, you know, acquired power. And so this notion that somehow, you know, our ability to make ourselves more respectable, somehow, you know, if we master, you know, the correct form of English, that somehow this will be an effective force, that we can, you know, get folks to respect us. That'll make it go away. But see, the very essence of the history of how black people have been treated in this country is disrespect. It's a blatant disbelief in your own humanity. I don't know any other way to see that. If you, you know, took a moment and thought about Baltimore, Maryland, and thought about, like, what actually happens in Baltimore, and thought about the, you know, the amount of violence in the average kid's life, you would feel ashamed of yourself for jumping up and down and hollering because they burnt down a CVS. You know, it might be apparent to you that, you know, if you were in the kind of neighborhood that Freddie Gray grew up in, where you could be arrested effectively for looking at a police officer wrong and running. That's not happening on the Upper East Side of Manhattan.
President Obama was one of those who was, in his way, his kind of quiet way, jumping up and down about those who were torching that CVS.
Right.
What's your reaction to his reaction to what happened?
Well, my reaction is that you shouldn't torch the CVS. You know, and I mean, I'm not here to endorse, you know, burning down buildings or arson. You know, and he's the president of the United States. You know, he's the head of state. So I understand his reaction. I think it's incumbent upon people like me who are writers, you know, who are not politically elected figures, to try to get the country to expand its imagination a little bit.
But could he do a better job of helping to expand that imagination in the work that he does and with the office that he holds? Because, you know, one of the things that people say who will argue with you on mm-hmm. talk shows is,
right.
You know, look, we've got a black president of the United States.
Right.
How much better could it possibly get? And we've heard this time and time and time again. Well,
right.
So he has this office. He has this platform. Could he do more?
I don't know that he could do better at expanding the imagination. I think he could do better at shrinking it, which is, I think, what he does a lot, unfortunately. Hmm. You know, I just, you know, went through this whole thing about respectability politics, and I find his embrace of that deeply, deeply depressing. I think it's sincerely held. I don't think it's an act. I think it's something he really believes. I think a lot of African-Americans believe it also. But I think the record, the basic historical record of respectability politics in this country, it speaks for itself. It's very, very sad for me personally. And thinking about, like, the many things I saw in Baltimore as a child. But I'll never forget walking home and six boys jumping off the bus, throwing me to the ground and stomping my head into the ground and people just walking past. This happened to everybody. And to know that there are, like, black boys and black girls right now who are growing up around that. And to see, you know, the president of the United States, who I know, you know, it's coming from a place of love. I don't think he's trying to hurt anybody. But to tell people that, you know, what's wrong with you is that you want to be like LeBron James. Half of America want to be like LeBron James. You know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of people that give up their whole career to be like, for just a year of being like LeBron James. But to basically tell these people, you know, effectively in being like other Americans, like, you don't really have that luxury. You don't really have the luxury of being like other kids. Now, there's an element of that, and I think this is what black folks would say, this, hey, man, that's actually true. That's what the fact of the reality is. But see, it's President Obama. Mm-hmm. It's President Obama. He's speaking for the entire American state. The head of the American state does not have a right to tell young black boys and young black girls who grow up under this violence, your problem is that you basically need to grow up quicker.
The housing that you write about in the piece, when you write about Chicago, these neighborhoods that are not simply poor, you write, are ecologically distinct, not simply the same thing as low economic status. In this pattern, Chicago is not alone. And this is something that you locate in Chicago, but clearly it is right here in Hartford, it is in Baltimore.
Yeah, no,
it's every
black
single
people
place.
Are. It's wherever you find communities of black people. And I think, like, there's a myth that liberals in this country and progressives tell themselves, And that is that the interest in the situation of African Americans in this country is roughly, you know, similar to that of poor whites. And so if we can just deal with economic issues, you know, if we can, you know, deal with class as an issue, we will necessarily, inevitably, if indirectly, deal with racism too. And in fact, it's just not true. It's just not true. Racism is a particular thing. You know, one way to think about this is, you know, as a sociologist down at NYU, Pat Sharkey, he did these neighborhood level studies. And what he found was that the average African American family that earns $100,000 a year lives in the kind of neighborhood that usually a white family making $30,000 a year lives in. When we talk about a black middle class, it's not actually the equivalent of a white middle class. You know, we don't actually, when we talk about white poor people in this country, you know, and black, it's not the equivalent. There's no way that you're going to be able to avoid this discussion. It's like, you know, when you lump black people, you know, and I will go so far as to say, you know, Latino people and poor white people into like one big, you know, clump and say, okay, here's the policy solution for everybody. No, it don't work like that. African-American history in this country is a particular thing. The history of white supremacy in this country directed towards African Americans is a very, very particular thing. And unless there are particular solutions, I don't see us getting out of this.
Hi, what's your name?
My name is Deborah. Could you, as a writer and especially a reporter, talk about narrative, how narrative, particularly distorted narratives, impact us as a nation, and also about how it impacts us on voting? Right. As participating as full citizens.
Right, of course, of course. I think narratives are very, very important. I was and am, you know, just someone who was hugely, you know, just greatly interested in the Civil War. And this is probably one of the most harmful narratives that we've ever, you know, taught. It is possible even now to have a conversation, you know, with someone in certain sectors of this country, hopefully not here in Connecticut, but actually probably in Connecticut. In fact, probably in Connecticut. And you can get into a good debate over what the Civil War was actually about. Now, wars are often complicated, okay? You say, well, what was World War I actually about? Well, you can have a pretty good debate about that. You know, the Civil War is perhaps the least complicated war in history in terms of trying to figure out what it was about. And you read the Declaration of Secession for South Carolina. Slavery's right there. For Virginia, it's right there. It's all right there. The vice president of the Confederacy stands up and gives the famous cornerstone speech and says Thomas Jefferson was totally wrong about all men, you know, being created equal. In fact, our new, you know, republic, our new civilization stands on the great truth that the Negro is not the equal of a white man, that his servile position is natural for him. And this is a great moral truth. And yet, you know, for at least, you know, for the past 150 years in this country, people act like it wasn't about slavery. But the fog is so thick, and the narrative we tell ourselves is so strong. Well, it's only possible to do that if you have a narrative that says, no, 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 they were fighting about the way of life. What way of life? What specifically about that way of life? No, 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 it was about the taxes. It was about, you know, the tariffs. What? Tariffs on what? Taxes on what specifically? And so that seems like a kind of, you know, just a sort of historical oddity. But see, if you can tell yourself that story about your country, then you can avoid the entire conversation about what slavery actually was. Then you can avoid uncomfortable questions about what in God's name would cause 600,000 people to just start killing each other. Why would that happen? Then you don't have to have that conversation. Then you can talk about affirmative action as special rights. Because see, you've annulled an entire portion of the history that explains how we got here in the first place. You can talk about all these sort of measures as things that are favors to black people. Because the entire history that stands as, you know, justification for why we have to do this in the first place has been taken off the table. Then you can take away somebody's right to vote and say that, well, you're just not fit to be a citizen. Has nothing to do with us trying to, you know, represent any particular interest. When did we do that? When in our history have we ever done that? Because the Civil War wasn't about slavery. So much of, you know, the ability, I think, to take away African-American rights, the plunder, is always justified by a story. There's always a story. The dominant majority in this country has to tell itself and tell the rest of the country about how we got here to make it possible to strip people of things.
But so if we have this big national conversation about reparations that you started and that maybe we have on the floor of the Congress someday, that fog is still there, right? That 300-year narrative is still there. Do you think that if we start to talk about it in the terms that you've laid out about reparations, that it changes anything about the way the people you just talked about are going to think about things, because it's the way they've been thinking about it for their entire lives and their families' entire lives?
Yeah, well, I suspect if this ever got to the floor of Congress, it would mean that the fog had significantly lifted. I mean, you got to think about this like a writer, like somebody writing a novel. I mean, you have to think, okay, what would have to be the conditions in this country for, you know, a measure for the study of reparations to actually get to the Congress? Well, first you got to get, you know, a fair number of representatives and congresspersons to sign on to that. And what's behind that? Well, it's the people that elected them. So how could it be that, you know, folks who are representing those people's interests would do that? Well, it must be that the people have come to see their interests a little differently. So that's a different world. So to put that in perspective, it's not that I expect, like, John Conyers' measure to pass and then America to change. I mean, the hope is that, the only way it could be is that America would change and then the measure would pass. That's the way, you know, it would have to work. And my idea to put this, just to put this out here, like, almost as like as a signpost, this is where we need to get to. This is where we're trying to get to, and it may, you know, take us, you know, several generations to get there, but this is actually what we should be aiming for. And I have to say, you know, just to be very, very clear about this, I don't think changing that narrative threatens the country's existence as much as maybe most people think it does. The fact of the matter is, America is not distinct in telling itself a particular myth of its own history. You know, I'm learning French, and I'm becoming this Francophile, and I love France, and I love Paris. But, well, they have a story that they tell themselves, too. They say, no, we don't have race. Everybody's French.
Yeah.
Everybody says, no, I mean, you know, it's quite obviously a myth. You know, and I suspect that this is true of most countries. And a national myth, you know, is not, you know, necessarily borne out by the reality. The difference with America is America goes around the world and tells people that it's exceptional. Well, you know, as I said, I propose to judge the country, my country, our country, by its own exceptional standard. So you don't get to plead the mediocrity of other nations. You know, if you want to be a leader on this too. You know, have a, you know, a realistic, you know, a view of yourself. Just one last thing to add to that. I can, you know, my great friend Jelani Cobb is in the audience tonight, and one of the things we often talk about, we both went to Howard University, and the transformative experience of being in that history department. And it wasn't transformative because they told us how cool it was to be black. In fact, it was the opposite. I mean, they really confronted us, you know, with the deeply uncomfortable, you know, ideas about black identity. You know, for instance, when you had a conversation about slavery, you didn't get to go up there, you know, in front of, you know, a Howard University history professor and say, well, white people kidnapped us out of Africa. No, that's not what happened. People who look like you sold you. Now deal with that. Think about it. What does it actually mean? And it's a deeply painful and frustrating process to have to reconstruct your identity, but it feels so much better when it's done.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is the winner of this year's Stowe Prize and the author of a 2014 Atlantic cover story called The Case for Reparations. We'll be back with more of our conversation after this break. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. This hour, we've been talking to Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's national correspondent at The Atlantic. He's an author, and he's the winner of the 2015 Stowe Prize for writing to advance social justice. He sat down with me last Thursday at Emmanuel Congregational Church in Hartford at the celebration for the award given by the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center in Hartford. We're coming back with Ta-Nehisi answering a question about why race is a factor in the conversation at all.
First of all, I sympathize with your question quite a bit. The one thing, and please don't take this as a rebuke. In fact, I'm just trying to refine this. The one thing that's more pernicious and dangerous than this concept of race is racism itself. And I think, like, if you think about it that way, that's like one of the reasons why we continue to talk about race, the race problem in America. When will we ever get past these issues of race? Race is something that we need to deal with. There needs to be a conversation about race. We need more harmony between the races. And what that presents is a worldview in which you have actual different races that are, you know, verifiable. And so there's a race that came out of Africa to this country. There was a race of Native Americans already living here. There's a race of, you know, untainted white people who are in this country. There's an Asian race here. And if we can get all of these fundamentally different people to get along with each other, then everything will be okay. But, you know, the reality of it is actually much more depressing. In fact, the very idea, these sort of divisions were invented. We created them. We created them. America was not the first time that people who we call white today and people who we call black today came in contact with each other. The stereotypes about black people being slow-witted, you know, more athletic, you know, less moral, all the other things that we associate, all the racist stereotypes we associate with black people have a curious coincidence with the transatlantic slave trade. So it's not a mistake that these ideas, you know, come out of nowhere. And what race effectively is a kind of justification for the commission of racist acts. That's the bottom line. And so how do I justify taking things from you? Well, I say you're part of a different race and you're inferior in this sort of way. And maybe today, you know, we don't fundamentally, directly, you know, believe in taking things. I mean, we clearly are involved in a system that does that, though. But if we drop the language of race, we would have to talk differently. We would have to say what happened in Baltimore, in this country, is not the result of the race problem in the America, it's the result of racism, which is a much more active way of talking about things. When we talk about our criminal justice system and observe the disproportionate number of African Americans that are involved in it, we would have to talk about racist policy. The ability to just, you know, say things, you know, it's a kind of, you know, it gives you a kind of passivity. It allows you to feel uninvolved, you know, and you can, you know, go with this myth that if folks just become a little bit more enlightened and a little bit more educated, everything will be okay. But the fact of the matter is racism is a done thing, and it's a thing we've done.
Go ahead.
I'm Jamil Ragland. A couple of weeks ago, or a few weeks ago, excuse me, the governor of Connecticut, a Democrat, Dan Malloy, he was promoting a bill that changed some of the ways that drug laws are enforced in Connecticut. And something that he said about the way that drug laws are enforced and the way that they target blacks and other brown people is that even if these laws initially, laws such as increased penalties in school zones, even if those laws weren't racist in intent, they are racist in outcome. And there was kind of like this explosion of anger that he even suggested such a thing. Like Republicans walked out of the legislature in a huff, and he was accused of poisoning the well for this debate by even suggesting that people weren't actually racist, but that laws has a racist outcome. It seems sometimes that when our leaders, political leaders, say things about race or racism, the conversation is automatically shut down, that we seem to want to get to the solution part without having the actual conversation. So how can we encourage or force, as the case may be, political leaders and other leaders around the country to actually confront these issues of racism, to actually even begin the conversation, because a lot of times it feels like the conversation is stopped as soon as someone brings it up?
Well, two things. The first thing is that, you know, I would argue actually a lot, when you talk about the criminal justice system in this country, actually a lot of these laws were racist in intent. And I think it's very, very, very important to acknowledge that. There's an idea that when we talk about the drug war, it was this second strategy that came up in 1970 under Nixon, or under, if you want to take it back a little further, under Goldwater, after Jim Crow fell. The fact of the matter, though, is in this country, the criminal justice system has been the dominant tool for stripping black people of rights in this country. The association between African-American civil rights and crime is not new. The drug war that, you know, we talk about now is actually the third drug war that we had just within the 20th century. They were always the same. You know, in 1913, when people start, you know, outlawing cocaine in this country, if you go back and look at what the congressional debate was, there was great fear over white supremacy. The idea, I mean, people, I'm not making it, people said this, that black men in the South were using cocaine and were turning superhuman, that they could repel bullets with their skin, that they were becoming super strong, that cocaine was improving their aim with guns. It's always been racist. So it didn't just become racist in 1970. You look at the record of, you know, the senators and the representatives that opposed a civil rights legislation. They didn't start talking about this with Nixon. They were saying at the time that civil rights legislation would lead to more crime. They were saying it back then. So I don't really know how one talks about, you know, if you want to have like any sort of national conversation about why our numbers look the way they do in terms of incarceration, for me, just defies any belief and any understanding of American history to say a world, and you know, we're going out on a ledge here, but in America without white supremacy would tolerate having the highest incarceration rate in the world. It defies possibility. I can't imagine it.
Hi, sir. What's your name?
Troy Brown. I'm from Hartford, Connecticut. I have a very simple question, at least I believe it's a simple question, and that is the case for reparations have been made for a long time by many other people. Can you tell me why now, in your article, it's actually getting the recognition that it's getting now?
My sense is that people, that we are lying to ourselves about the effects and the legacy of racism in this country. And I think a lot more people know that than are saying it. Sometimes you know something and you walk around and it's heavy on your head, and then somebody just strips it back and says, this is what it is.
It had this impact and it started this conversation, and then like a month after it came out, we started seeing this terrible string of events in Ferguson and Staten Island and in North Charleston, and it's been this kind of unbelievable year since then. I guess I'm wondering if you can reflect on the context of this piece that deals with so many of these issues and that essentially comes all the way back around to your hometown of Baltimore.
Right. Well, here's the thing. There has been a kind of technological revolution in this country where you can actually record police officers doing things. But it actually didn't start last year. And we started seeing more video last year. That's really, really what happened. But for people who have lived in African-American communities, I mean, this sort of interaction with the police is not new at all. I mean, it's been going on for a long time. And then it hit me about 2 or 3 years ago, something racist will always happen. But I got a piece that's coming out in October. I guarantee you it'll be right on time.
We've got time for one more question. Hi, sir, what's your name?
My name is Leonardo. I'm from Connecticut River Academy. As you can tell, I'm a high school student. So with the whole growing society and growing generation, what is your opinion on using the N-word with blacks against each other to show love and friendship instead of hatred?
Well, I mean, I guess I'm in a church. I hate that I even have to use the word, the N-word, to have this conversation, but I guess I should. This is not going to be very popular. But, you know, this is like what I said, I didn't come anywhere to become popular. I have absolutely no problem with black people using the N-word. I grimace even as I say the N-word. I think it's completely normal and completely human for African Americans to use the N-word. Words mean something within particular contexts. And, you know, I wrote about this before. When I was a young man and I would go to Philadelphia with my dad's name is William Paul Coates, my grandmother would call my father Billy. And my Aunt Joyce would call my father Billy. I understood that I did not have the right to call my father Billy. I understood that would have been a confrontation. I knew that. There was a relationship between my father and my grandmother. There was a relationship between my father and my Aunt Joyce that I just didn't have. I didn't have the ability to say that. People who love each other, who are in couples, who are married, girlfriend, boyfriend, tend to address themselves in ways that strangers are not allowed to address them. So, I mean, you may call your wife baby or honey. When I meet you and your wife, I will not address her as baby or honey. That's not our relationship. We don't have the same relationship, and we understand that. Not only that, we understand that people use speech in ironic ways, and people are very, very self-deprecating. We understand, for instance, there's a magazine out called Hebe. I do not assume that gives me the right to then call Jewish people Hebes. We talk about, you know, the LGBT movement in this country, you know, frequently makes use of the word queer. Queer studies is a statement that people use. I do not assume that this gives me the right to call somebody that's gay queer. Toby Keith had this album out called White Trash with Money. I am not going up to white people of a certain socioeconomic status and addressing them as white trash. I understand that there's a different relationship there. It's only when black people begin to use the tools of irony themselves, when they begin to talk amongst themselves in a way that all human communities in this world talk, when they begin to obey the same rules that all human communities in this world obey, that you have some sort of problem. Now, I understand that, you know, it's a problem because African-American culture, you know, occupies a particular place in pop culture, and people feel uncomfortable because they want to sing certain lyrics, but they can't say certain things. Well, I mean, deal with it, man. Life is hard. Life is hard. We got to deal with much more than not being able to sing a certain DMX lyric. You know, things get a lot harder than that. That was not Freddie Gray's problem, for instance. He had much bigger problems than that. And so I understand why it makes people, you know, uncomfortable. You know, there's, you know, this woman on TV, Ashley Bainfield on CNN, saw her dressing down this African-American politician in Baltimore. She's dressing him down, saying, I don't think anybody should be able to use, you know, the N-word. And I'm like, who are you? Who are you to come to my community and tell us how we get to talk? The problem is this. White people invented the N-word as a way to degrade people. They use it as a way to put people in there as part of that narrative, to take things from people. And the idea that black people would add some degree of ingenuity to it, to add some degree of irony, to find some other way to appropriate it, to flip it, to remix it, and to use it somehow themselves, and then to dare say to them, no, you can't do it. It's just offensive.
I'll just ask you as we close, does this get better? Obviously, palpably?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to live under Jim Crow. Yeah, I don't think that would be. I don't think nothing's changed. More depressing is why things change. And I think that things don't change in the way and for the reasons that give us comfort. One of the unfortunate things about American history and the African-American struggle in this country is every time there's been some sort of progress, some grand sort of progress for black people, it's always because white people had some ulterior interests. That's just always been true, you know? And so the Civil War happens, right? I mean, Abraham Lincoln, who I adore and who I love, you know, says it out loud. He says, listen, this is not, you know, about, this is about union. This is about union, until it couldn't be about union anymore. But when it started off, it was about, if I could preserve the union by freeing no slaves, I would do it. I would do it. And yet it became clear that there could not be an actual union with slaves, that they had to make it a war, and so black people get an advance, right? When we think about the civil rights movement, we think about nonviolent protesters, we think about Martin Luther King, we think about John Lewis, SNCC, SCLC, NAACP. We think about these people with these great, you know, shows of bravery, which did happen. It's a real thing. I mean, just like the 54th was brave. I mean, it actually happened. And yet it's hard to ignore the fact that this happened within the shadow of the Cold War. Bull Connor was an embarrassment for American foreign policy. I mean, the Freedom Rides were an embarrassment for American foreign policy. And so there was an interest there. Would there have been as much progress without that? I don't know. If you're an activist, if you're any sort of citizen that you know, has some sort of concern about things getting better, I actually think you have to have some humility about your own powers and your own abilities. I think like that's ultimately how you can't just, you know, you pin your entire life and your entire happiness on events that are ultimately really out of your control. You know, and as an African American, where you occupy 13% of the population, you just can't do it. You just can't do it. You go out there, you struggle, and you fight as hard as you can. You hope you win. You understand that most people doing the right thing actually do not. And you make your peace with that. And I think that's about all, you know, that we're entitled to. I'm sorry.
That's Ta-Nehisi Coates from our conversation last Thursday at Emmanuel Congregational Church in Hartford. Coates was here to receive the 2015 Stowe Prize for Writing to Advance Social Justice. Special thanks to Shannon Burke, Mary Ellen White, Catherine Kane, and the entire staff of the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center. Our program was produced by Betsy Kaplan, Lydia Brown, Kyone Wolf, and Eugene Amatruda. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.